building Generation X leaders, the minutes that I have with you in this hour, I am intentionally not going to give you a how to do it, because I will give you some general ideas and categories. Mainly what I would like to do in the time with you is a couple of things. I would like to just share with you some of the perspectives that I'm gaining and have gained in terms of this generation and in terms of what leadership is and how to build leaders, and hopefully come to a place at the end of the time where you can begin to see some steps that you can take both in your own life and leadership and in the organizations that you lead to begin to build Generation X leaders. A book that's related to this, a friend of mine told me I have a crummy title at this point, but it's at this point entitled Winning the Right to Influence, and it's going to be written to managers in corporate settings, helping them to understand how to lead and motivate the 20-something generation. And who knows if anyone other than my mother will ever buy a copy of it, but I feel like before the Lord I need to, and John's going to buy one to do that. For biblical perspective, in Acts 13:36, yes, Martha? Of which? Okay. And one thing I would like is for this to be free-flowing, you know, questions, comments, please don't throw anything. In Acts 13:36, there is, to me, a wonderful summary verse of one of the great men of history, King David. And remember, when you think of King David, please do not put him in a bathrobe and in antiquity and therefore irrelevant. He was very much a leader. He was a political leader. He was a religious leader. He was not a very good leader in his family in some ways, but very much a good, gifted leader. And as it summarizes David's life, of all the ways it could summarize it, you could say a lot of things, just like when I was introducing Harold last night. How do you introduce Harold? You could say so many things, and you have to choose a few. When you summarize David's life, it says, "And David, after he served the purposes of God for his generation, went to sleep and died and went to be with his fathers." And the idea that what this man's life really was about was that at a specific time in history, in his generation, he served the purposes of God. I think that in our ministries on campus, as we begin to think about leadership development, one of the great challenges for us will be to think large enough. Because we're going to be very tempted to think very small. Basically, we want warm bodies that will fit into the slots in our organization. Or we want warm bodies who will recruit other warm bodies to fit into the slots of our ministry. And that is important because it's all about people. But one of the challenges we're going to have as we actually think about leadership development, and especially with this generation, is to think big enough and to think, how can I help these students to see the great adventure of becoming equipped so that they can serve the purposes of God for their generation? So that's kind of my frame of reference. Now, I think that if I was speaking in a corporate setting and put together the idea of Generation X and leadership, there would be a lot of people who would laugh out loud. Because in corporate settings, there's a general consensus that Generation Xers don't know the first thing about leadership or loyalty. I very much disagree with that. I think in a ministry situation, one of the things we feel similar to that is frustration. Because it seems like in a lot of places in our country and in a lot of ministries, they just don't fit and attach like they used to. And so with the Generation Xers, thinking about leadership development is a real challenge. I would like for us to spend just a few minutes there in number two, defining leadership. And the reason for this is because if we don't understand what we mean by leadership, then as we think about, oh my gosh, I need more leaders on my campus, we're going to be hard-pressed as to what are we really saying here. So instead of defining it based upon your organizational structure, how you have your ministry structured, let's talk about just some general ideas, some concepts about what leadership is. In our organization, in Leadership Edge, we have a little one-sentence definition of leadership. And that is positively impacting your sphere of influence with the positive involvement of others in the process. Positively impacting your sphere of influence with the positive involvement of others in the process. Now that's a good definition. I don't think it's a great definition. It has worked well for us thus far. But it's the idea, okay, one more time with feeling, positively impacting your sphere of influence with the positive involvement of others in the process. The idea is, it's not just me going out doing something, even something that has positive impact. But it also has to do with me casting a vision and recruiting people, involving people, so that we're moving together in this. I'm going to move this out of the way because I can't see Neil well enough. I was speaking to the board of deacons at a large Baptist church in North Carolina a few months ago on servant leadership. And this church has a group of men who are their deacons who are very much servants of God. They just serve the people of the church. They hospital visit. They have a widow's ministry. Incredible servants. But they wanted me to speak on servant leadership. And one of the things I said to the men that morning is, if you're wanting to evaluate how you did as a servant leader at the end of this term of deacon service, it will not be evaluated by how many hospital visits you made. It'll be evaluated by how many people in the church you helped to see the vision of hospital visitation and took them with you and involved them in the process so that they began to become a part of hospital visitation. That will be the way you'll evaluate servant leadership. It's one thing to be a servant. It's another thing to be a servant leader. Jesus was both. When he washed the disciples' feet, he served them. And then he said, "Do you see what I've just done? Now, just as I've done, you need to do the same thing." He involved them in the process. Another definition, if you wanted another one of leadership, basic definition is a leader is one who has followers. And sometimes that may be basic, but sometimes we fool ourselves into thinking we're leaders, and yet there's really no one following. It's a rather demotivating experience. When we think about leadership, and a lot of this section is stuff I learned from Harold and then through some books that Harold directed me to and some other things that I've done along the way. When we talk about leadership, we talk about that there are three aspects that make up leadership. We call them the three C's: character, competence, and commitment. Character, competence, and commitment. Character has to do with who you are on the insides, the moral qualities, the ethical qualities, the values that you live by. As one author said, who you are when the lights are turned out and no one's looking. Your character, the moral quality fiber of your life. And the leader's character has to sustain the weight of the responsibility that his life carries. Character. The second thing is competence. Competence has to do with actually having the skills and the abilities where you can help a group of people get from specific point A to specific point B. Competencies. The best book I have read on competence in leadership is the one Kuzis and Posner, The Leadership Challenge. Be sure to buy the revised edition, which is this one, this weird yellow color. It's very usable and also is a lot more current. What Kuzis and Posner did in this book is now I think they've interviewed about 2,500 senior executives and asked them, when your leadership was at its best, what were you doing? And from that, Kuzis and Posner distilled five competencies that leaders need to have. And then in Leadership Edge, we've added two to that. Let me give you these seven competencies. So we've talked about leadership as character, competence, and commitment. Under competence, the first thing is challenging the process. Challenging the process. Basically, leaders don't want everything to stay the way they are. They want things to change. They challenge the process to begin to think through, how could we do this better? How could we have broader influence? How could we do this for the sake of difference sake, but so that we could really have a broader impact, a deeper impact, be more effective at what we're doing? Challenging the process. Second competency is inspiring a shared vision. How can I help people to see the vision of how we could do it different? How the process could be better. Back in the early days, again, Harold is an illustration with the planting of hope. Hope Church was challenging the process. And when Harold began Hope with those 13 core members, he had inspired a shared vision among us, among them, to where we had begun to see how it could be different. In some ways, how it could be better, how it could be more effective. One thing about inspiring a shared vision is the leader no longer owns the vision. It becomes all of our vision. And sometimes for leaders, that's a scary thing because we feel like we've got to control it. But anyhow, challenging the process, inspiring a shared vision. The third thing is enabling others to act. Helping the team to see, okay, who's going to do what? Here's the vision. This is where we want to go. This is point A. We want to get to point B. How do we get there? Who's going to do what? Dividing up the labor, enabling others to buy in. But it's very important to realize at this point, it's not just putting people into slots. It's helping people to see, if we're going to accomplish this vision, this is the work that needs to be done. Who's going to do what? How are we going to do it? Enabling others to act. The fourth one is modeling the way, where leader, by your example, by your commitment, by the values you live out, you model the way of how we as a team are going to do this. Modeling the way. And then the fifth one is encouraging the heart, where you help people stay motivated. When I speak to men's groups, we talk about becoming cheerleaders with hairy legs, you know, where you learn to cheer for each other, and yet it comes out of a life of credibility, so it's not just frivolous sugar, but it really reaches into the depths of the people and encourages their hearts to move forward in the accomplishment of the vision. The sixth thing that we talk about is maintaining accountability. The leader must maintain accountability to the organization that he's a part of, to the stakeholders, to the culture. Maintaining accountability. And then the seventh one under competencies is maintaining personal perspective and balance so that as you become a long-term leader, your life doesn't self-destruct through the process, or because you lose personal perspective and balance, you chew up other people. Long-term leaders have to make a commitment that they will maintain personal perspective and personal balance. So when we talk about competencies, those are the seven competencies that in Leadership Edge we talk about. So what, you tell me, if you're a person, if you're a leader of character but not of competence, how will the people think of you? Okay. They'll love being around you. They'll even be influenced by the goodness of your life. But you know, there just never will be a sense that we're getting anywhere. I'll be very honest. I think most of us in ministry are like that. Tend to be like that, unless we're of a very strong choleric personality. We tend to equate leadership with character influence. And that is very much a part of it. But sometimes one of the reasons we have a problem attracting strong student leaders into our ministries is because they look at our organizations and don't get a sense that we're going anywhere. And if they themselves are a strong leader, they want to go somewhere. So if you're a person of character and not competence, people will love you, but they won't have a sense you're going anywhere. If you're a person of competence but not character, what happens? Okay, you're going somewhere. You just don't know if you want to buy a ticket, because there's a very good chance you might get chewed up in the process, or at least used up in a bad way in the process. If you're a leader of character and competence, but you're not committed, it doesn't matter. Commitment is the clutch that engages the gears. So leaders have to be people of character and competence, and also of commitment. Yes, please.
I'm curious, that's something religious. In our country, you can become a leader without character.
Okay. In the election last term, it seemed like most people thought George Bush was a person of character. They very much began to wonder about his competence, and he was very hard-pressed to inspire a shared vision. Whereas I think there was a general question about Bill Clinton's character, but he was able to help enough people to think, I can help us to move forward. And in that, I'm not slamming or exalting anybody. It's just I agree with what you're saying, and I think in the last election, that was very much evident. And I won't comment on that. Okay. So, one last thing about the defined leadership, and then we're going to get to the students. How is leadership learned? How do you learn how to be a leader? I think that the research has shown, and this fits, I think, with reality, that there are three ways that you learn leadership. One way is through education. Formal education, where, say, like in a classroom setting, you learn different things about leadership. So education under that would be formal education, and then formal training, where you're not just learning the theory, but you're actually learning how to do leadership. Formal education, formal training. So one third of how you learn leadership is through education. Another third is through observation. Observation, where you look at different people you know, maybe peers, and you begin to see the effect they have on people. Or you look at people who are role models or mentors or exemplars, and you begin to learn how they do it. And this really fits with Proverbs. Another place that you can observe is by negative example, bad examples of leadership. Proverbs says, consider the sluggard, you know, what you don't want to be. So we observe, we can learn through observation, through relationships, through role modeling and mentoring, through bad examples. Another third of how we learn to be leaders is trial and error. Trial and error. And there's usually in here several ingredients. One is hardships, where we get in adverse circumstances and learn that either we're going to learn how to lead or this thing's going to go down. Job experience, where we have different requirements in our job and we have to learn how to lead in those contexts. Or job assignments, where we are given this for a while and then we're turned into this assignment. Seemed like one of the strengths of some of the early navigator ministry was the different kinds of assignments they would put their key people into to learn leadership in lots of different areas, where Dawson Trotman would loan his people out to other people, and the cross training from that was incredible. So this first part here has been on defining leadership, and I hope that you can see in here this really is a lot bigger than just sticking people in the slots of our ministry. When we talk about leadership, it's a bigger thing than that. Now let's move down to number three, values of this generation. You know, I don't know about you, and here I am writing a book on Generation Xers, but I'm kind of sick, you know, of the Generation X thing. I don't know. You just, in a sense, you just have to let them be who they are. I think for every poll that says they're slackers, there's a poll that says they're entrepreneurs, you know. I think that in understanding the generation, one of the ways to understand it is to understand the cultural influences that they have lived through and the impact that that has had on them. But let's talk about three values that I think tend to be pretty much universal with the Generation X. You may not think this on your campus, and it may not manifest on your campus, but in general terms, I think this is true. The first value has to do with loyalty. Loyalty. A good many people in this generation have not one ounce of loyalty to an organization. That's just the honest to goodness truth. My father-in-law, God bless him, is 79 years old. That man has 40-something years perfect attendance at the Shelby Lions Club. 40-something years of perfect attendance at the Shelby Lions Club. He's not a Rotarian. He's not a Civitan. He's not in the JCs. He is in the Shelby Lions Club, and he's got 40-something years of perfect attendance. Now, my generation looks at that and thinks, you know, well, maybe. This generation, Generation X, looks at that and they pity the man. I mean, if they feel anything, they think, this poor man had nothing else to do in his life. He had nothing to do. When I was coming through in the 70s in college, there was a sense of identity to ministries. I'm in Navigators. And that meant something. I'm not in Campus Crusade. I'm not in BSU. I'm in the Navigators. This is what Navigator stands for. And there was a great sense of pride back then. You know, and we were not removed enough from, say, Dawson Trotman or Bill Bride or some of the founders of the ministries back then, to where there was a real sense of, I'm in this group, and this is what we stand for. And books like Dawes would come out and it would just reinvigorate us to know this is what our organization stands for. This generation doesn't have that to most any kind of institution, whether it's a job or it's your college ministry. And so they have loyalty, but their loyalty is not to the organization, it's to a few people within the organization. That is where they are very loyal, but they are not brand loyal to your organization. They are very loyal to a few people within your organization. And that has a lot of implications when we think about leadership development, because if we're trying to sell them on a four-year plan into our organization, and that's going to be the key to building leadership, they're not going to come in understanding the value of that. Do you understand what I'm saying? A lot of times they look at our, well, we'll get to that in a minute, but just trust me at this point that loyalty, they are loyal. It's just not to an organization generally. And they may say to you, you bet I'm going to be in BSU 4 years. What that means is I'm here this semester as long as my friends are. And if my friends move to this ministry or if something bigger happens over here, then I'll see you later. That generally is what they mean. Okay. So, values. Second value is the idea of control. Students I relate to have a phrase called anal retentive, or sometimes they shorten it to anal. What that has to do with is they will not be controlled. They will not be controlled. And if they think that what our ministry is all about is fitting them into our little boxes and our little niches, they're not real into that. And they're not real into me dictating morality to them. They're not real into me dictating. The interesting thing that kind of balances that is they are very much open to being mentored and influenced. They don't want to be controlled, but boy, if you can come alongside them and say, I think I can give you some help in getting ready for life and getting ready for the marriage, family, and career that you long for, then you've got them by the heart. This is something I have to be careful with, but almost any time that I speak before a student group, I will somehow tie what I say, especially if it's about leadership, I will tie it back to their future marriage and family. Because I'm telling you, in this generation, as deep down to their toes, they long for a good marriage and a good family. And yet they are so scared that they will not know how to do it right, that they are postponing marriage longer than any generation in our country's history. So they don't want to be controlled. I spoke at the FCA at TCU about a year or two ago on the challenges of being married and having kids in the 90s, which is a weird topic for FCA, but I don't care. I mean, it's what they needed to hear, I felt like. And so it was well received. And the next morning I was sitting in the cafeteria at TCU and two female students came up to me and they said, you're Mr. Hawkins, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And one of those girls looked at me with tears streaming down her face. And she said, I just want you to know that what you talked about last night is what I dream about. And I looked at her and I said, I just want you to know that you should keep on dreaming. And you should keep on growing to know the Lord Jesus, because He will help you to become the wife and the mother that you long to be. It's just in their hearts. It's in their hearts. So it's control. They don't want to be controlled. They do want to be mentored. The third thing is entrepreneurism. Entrepreneurism. They are used to creating their own structures because they've grown up in a culture that didn't give them structures. Dad worked, mom worked, sometimes several jobs. I think it's 40 to 50% of middle schoolers and high schoolers in the 80s were latchkey kids. They've had to create their own structures, and because of things like MTV and others, they've had to create their own structures out of chaos. They've had to put it together themselves. And so, and please get this point. If they look at our ministry and hear us saying, doggone it, why won't you jump through my hoops? It will give this generation every reason they need to walk right around your hoops and do something else. They will not. I think the lowest place in leadership is when a leader is cussing under his breath, and I've been there, and said, why won't you jump through my hoops? Because at that point, the leader has lost vision, and the leader is no longer calling people to vision. He's just frustrated because his system isn't working. And we all get there. We just can't all stay there. So entrepreneurism, we need to in some ways open up things. I think we need to in some ways drop some of the hoops of our organization and begin to think that there really is the chance of losing some control but gaining broader influence. That is a key sort of concept in corporate management today and in college leadership. Losing some, giving up some control. A leader should never give up all control unless there's no other choice. But giving up some control in order to gain broader influence. Okay. So, with the structures that we present to them, and this is actually going to get to where we're going in a minute. With the structures we present to them, we used to do kind of the council thing, which was basically a replication of Washington, D.C., you know. We have the president, we have vice president, and then we just have this huge bureaucracy under here. You know, we got church relations, we got missions, we got evangelism, we just got all these little cabinet things, and then they got people under them, and it's just a flow chart of little slots. And one positive thing about the council thing of doing it was the flow chart really communicated this is a student thing. I mean, if this superstructure is going to work, students are going to have to do it. The problem was we began to breed hypocrisy because we were putting students in what we were calling leadership positions who did not have the credentials to be a leader, both spiritually and otherwise. And so for the sake of warm bodies filling slots, we were filling the slots like the big dog, but we were breeding a hypocritical kind of leadership a lot of times on a lot of campuses. Now, you may not agree with that, but that's Hawk's big idea on how that was working out. In the teamwork model, the model that Max and some others have put together, we have more of a almost like a pyramid approach where freshmen come in at the base level onto the freshman ministry team. And then as they fulfill that responsibility, they go up to the, I think it's the discipleship team, and then from the discipleship team up to the ministry team, and they stay in that and begin leading further through. I think all of y'all are familiar with that. I think one of the challenges of that approach is, with this generation, it can be understood this way. If you'll join our pyramid organization for 4 years, and if you're a freshman, you go in this slot, generic rather than niche, you know, freshman this slot, sophomore this slot, junior this slot. If you'll join our group for 4 years and kind of generically fit into these slots, then we'll give you three things. We'll help you to develop good friendships, we'll help you to learn how to walk with the Lord, and we'll help you to learn how to lead dorm Bible studies. I think that a lot of our generation of students looks at that, and they're not mad at it at all. But they look at that and they say, now tell me one more time why you think I would do that. Why do you think I would make a 4-year commitment to any organization? And if I wanted to make friends, why would I trust an institution to help me make friends? Now that just doesn't make sense, because that's almost antithetical to them, friends and organizations. And if I wanted to grow in the Lord, me and probably a few of my friends could figure that out, and I don't want to lead a dorm Bible study. So now tell me one more time, why would I do this? You know, the problem is it appears irrelevant to a large part of this generation. I don't think it is irrelevant. I am not saying it is. I don't believe it is. I think as long as we're on this earth, we need discipling, evangelizing ministries on the campus. But I do think we need to kind of an outsider's look at it to say there is going to be a lot of this generation who looks at the structure that we put in front of them, and it will appear irrelevant. Because what I'm asking is, how do I get over what's already happened to me? How do I get ready for marriage? How do I get ready to be a father? And how in this world am I going to get a job that will mean something to me with what's happened to the job market? Do you see what I'm saying? I'm not asking at this point, do you agree with what I've just said, but do you understand what I'm saying there about the relevance issue? Is there any confusion about that? So, yes. Well, I think there are four questions they're asking. One is, how do I get over what's already happened to me? And this isn't just if they grew up in a dysfunctional family. This is the culture this generation has grown up in. See, we talk postmodernism like it's a philosophical construct, and in some ways it is, but these are the children of postmodernism. So, how do I get over what's already happened to me? How could I ever have the kind of marriage that in my heart I long for? And yet I have seen so few models that have lasted that I don't know what to do. Third, how could I be the kind of father? One of the brightest business students at Texas Christian University, almost a 4.0, when he graduated, he said, if what my goal is in the next 10 years, I want to make a ton of money, and then I want my wife and I to buy a ranch way out in Montana somewhere, and it just be our family, and the world just leave us alone. You know, that's what one of the sharpest students got a scholarship to MBA school. That's what he wants. So how to get over what's already happened? How could I ever have the kind of marriage I long for? How could I ever have the kind of family? See, we laugh at Leave It to Beaver. And there is some unreal parts of Leave It to Beaver. But I'm telling you, most of this generation would give anything in this world they have if they could have grown up in that house. And then the fourth thing is, how will I ever have a career that has meaning and has the kind of salary and money and personal fulfillment that I'm longing for? So those are four questions. So let's get down there to vision. I think that if we're going to have success at building Generation X leaders, there are going to need to be some things true in our own vision. One of the things is that we really do need to personally have a vision to build leaders, not just to build slot fillers and recruiters of slot fillers. You know, there's a lot of research about the difference between management style or management task and leadership task. A basic way to say it is that managers, what they really want is consistency and order. They want to build a nice kind of cyclical system that they can just keep humming on through eternity and stick a few more people in it as it goes on. So managers tend to want consistency and order, whereas leaders tend to want movement and change. The truth of the matter is, any long-term organization has to have both. But when we're talking about building Generation X leaders, I think we really have to have a commitment that we're not just trying to build managers. We're trying to build leaders who exemplify character, competence, and commitment. So one thing under vision is that we have a vision to build leaders. The second thing is that we have a vision to not just build our little ministry structure, but that we have a vision to penetrate the campus. I think sometimes when we see the whole thing through our little structure, we begin thinking too small. And our people begin thinking too small, and it's all about getting people in pews and people in slots. And we have to explode that into thinking, God, how throughout this campus do you want us to penetrate it? With the housekeeping staff in the dorms, with possibly some of the faculty and administrators, with all kinds of students, how do you want us to penetrate this culture? We really have to think about campus ministry as a cross-cultural ministry experience, where we're not just trying to set up our little group in the middle of something, but where we're trying to penetrate an entire culture. Because if you think like that, then you will understand the need for leadership and the need for student leadership. The challenge about that is it won't all fit back into your program. And in some ways, it will be more like a sending base with satellites. And part of that sending base will be, say, the teamwork model. But the whole idea isn't to get everybody back into our tent every Wednesday night at 7. But it's to have a broad, penetrating impact on the campus. The third part of our vision, I think, is that we need to be training them for life leadership, not just BSU leadership. If we prove that we can do that, we will have more to do than we can do. We need to have a vision to train them for life leadership, not just BSU leadership. And one of the parts of that is when we're helping them to become leaders in our BSUs, we need to kind of have two visions. One is, here's why it's important that you learn to be a leader in this area for the BSU. But much bigger than that, one of these days you're going to be in a marriage, you're going to be in a family, you're going to be in a career. And if you learn these leadership abilities now, here's how it will fit in what your heart longs for out there. So a vision for life leadership, not just BSU leadership. Number six, under our example, I think one of the things that we have to ask ourselves individually is, how do I exhibit leadership? Am I more of just a manager trying to get some system going that we can keep going and just stick people in? Or do I tend to just be sort of an influence guy who by my character has some leadership, but who really does not have the competence to help a group of people get from point A to point B? When I was on staff at Hope in the late 80s, Harold took our staff through this book, and I went through an identity crisis. Because for a number of years, rightfully or wrongfully, I had thought of myself as a leader. And some people had told me I was a leader, and that I was a godly leader. And in a lot of ways, that was true. Because I think in some ways my character was able to call people on. I think the challenge I realized was I did not know the first thing in this world about competence, about helping people to see a vision and as a group move from point A to point B. I spent 10 years of my life fumbling with that and finally beginning to learn that. So one thing about our example is, how do we exhibit leadership in our own lives? And how do we need to grow in leadership? And I think another part about our example is, are we life leaders? Or is it just we kind of turn on leadership when the BSU is doing their thing, but then when we're in our own home, we're not a leader to our wife and kids? Or when we're in the other context of our life? Because leadership, I don't think, can be compartmentalized. It's not that you're always in charge of everything, but the basic character, competence, and commitment has to be filled throughout all of our lives. The last thing we have there is our commitment. I think that if you're going to be a ministry leader who builds Generation X leaders, here are some commitments you're going to have to make. The first thing is a commitment of time. I think you have to learn how to build leaders, period. But you really do have to learn how to build leaders with this generation, because there's a large part of this generation that's just died inside. And the idea of actually helping them to feel something, much less lead in something. And sometimes with students, you shouldn't even talk about leadership. You should talk about influence. They can understand influence. It's very hard for them. Some with our students about what we see in their lives, both the strengths and the growth areas. It will take collaboration, where there's really a sense of, in our ministry, man, we're all in this together. And we're all committed to moving this thing forward together. Take a commitment of trying to understand this generation, not just say mean things about them or force them through our hoops. I think it's a great time for humility as we lead with this generation, that they see God-built humility in our lives. And I think that it really does take a commitment that I am really here to help you to get ready for life. And I'll say that in words, but I'll prove it to you by my actions. Proverbs says, many men declare their loyalty, but who can find a faithful man? I think this generation is dying to find faithful men and women who will help them to get ready for the challenges before them. We had a class at Duke this spring. It was a class where we were going through this book, Leadership Challenge, with a group of students who identified themselves as Christian student leaders. Some of them were leaders in different ministries like InterVarsity or Campus Crusade at Duke. Some of them are Christians who are leaders like in student government or in residential life or different areas. But all of them were students who were in leadership positions were Christians. One guy, a guy called young Matt Sweeney, Matt just finished his freshman year. It was just about this time last year that Matt, before he came to Duke, became a Christian through the witness of his brother. And Matt signed up for the class, a very sharp young man, very motivated leader kind of student. And went through the class, and he and I now are in a discipling kind of relationship. But we had the class over to our house for dinner one night at the end, and we were going around the circle kind of talking about the class. And Matt looks up and he says, you know, when I signed up to be in this class, I didn't have any idea what I was going to be. And he said, but you know, even more than that, I did not think that the Bible had one thing in this world to say about my future as a business person and as a husband and father. And I have come to realize it has everything to say about that. And I'm like, yes, he saw it. You know, he saw the relevance that the Lord God has for their future. That's all that I have to say. We can take just a couple of minutes for questions, and then we need to be faithful to move into the prayer time. But are there any questions? Neil?
John, what do you see, gifts of leadership impacting this? Do you feel like more leadership, I guess maybe three more points, what do you see the gifts of leadership impacting it?
Well, that's one of the reasons we use that definition we use. Because one thing I do believe is that everyone can learn to positively impact their sphere of influence in some way, and in some way involve others in the process. So that's kind of a threshold. I think that gifting really does have a lot to do with both the orientation that your leadership will take, and if we could talk about levels of leadership, the level to which you will get to as a leader. It's both, I guess, kind of learned, caught, and gifted. And that's why I think one of the commitments is understanding. I think part of the understanding has to do with really thinking through their lives and really thinking through with where this student's at right now and with what I think this student longs for in life and what I think God longs for with this student. What would be the next step that this student is capable of to grow to be a person of influence? Does that get at that? Okay. Other questions or comments?
John, are you saying that we parse this one? There's no sense of ever thinking about what you're saying. And what these people, what the kids who are coming through are looking for, somebody's going to help them with life.
Somebody's going to help them what?
With life.
Yes, yes.
As opposed to us teaching them what they, we think they need to know, we need to help them with what they think they need to know. In the process of all of that,
we help them
to see that Jesus really is the focus of all of this.
Yes, and is exceedingly relevant. I mean, just take your breath away relevant.
We're answering questions they're going to ask.
Well, and you know, when I, again, everything, why do I say that I didn't learn from Harold hardly? But, you know, back in the early days in the training, we would talk about felt needs and real needs. And how you really do have to address both. And this generation, see, you look at this generation and you just get overwhelmed with their real needs. But a lot of times their felt needs are screaming so loud that they just can't hear. And that's a commitment we have to make to be willing to enter in, I guess, both. Yes, Neil?
You think that you're talking about the values of this generation, and I know we've thought a lot about that and tried to figure that out some. And each one of the different things that you cited, like with the Lions Club, with mm-hmm. you know, the different groups of people come up with the NAS, per se, and then this generation with more than a couple. Do you think in each of those that it's really an expression of how those people understand community? Mm-hmm. That it's like, community to one generation was, well, you know, your perfect attendance in the Lions Club, because these people are the community that I relate to.
Mm-hmm.
These people are my community. And then it kind of got, you know, well, not all these people are my community, but kind of like NAV people are my community. And now people understand more community as, you know, there's a few people that I experience community with. It's these two or three.
Mm-hmm.
But even though I'm a part of this organization, which is maybe a part of the Lions Club thing, which is maybe mm-hmm. part of the world in general, I can only experience community. Kind of a community thing.
Yes, I do. And I think one of the things that fuels that is the fracture of trust. There have been so few organizations and people that they have really been able to trust to be there to help them and to be there for them, that they are so used to just, let's get three or four and us, you know. And that's, say, one of the things in corporate context where there's a real movement towards teams within corp. One of the things I think that fuels that is the orientation, but it makes management very different, where instead of managing a hierarchy, you're trying to build interdependent communicating teams that are committed to moving, in general terms, towards the same direction. In some ways, I think it's a lot more fun, but it's a lot less structured and a lot less controlled. So, yeah, I would think so. Yes, sir?
Do you feel like at some point, you know, when they're first entering whatever it is you're doing and they're loyal to the two or three, do you feel like at some point that loyalty shifts to the leader within that organization, and even though the one or two may leave,
mm-hmm.
because this person is, well, mm-hmm. I trust this person for whatever reasons, I'm going to stick with this because I'm also this person.
Well, again, I think because of their orientation towards being mentored, yes. But again, it's just basically shifting one small group to a small another small group. And I think that's one of the reasons why one of the... it's incremental with this generation. And one of the incremental theological concepts we have to help them begin to understand is the body of Christ. Ecclesiology. Because they don't have an understanding of ecclesiology. And for them to... And we're going to talk about this in my other workshop. For them to make it in the real world after graduation... They need to be growing in understanding ecclesiology and understanding what the body of Christ is. Yes, sir.
So we're not hesitant. I mean, once you begin to establish kind of relationships, you're not hesitant moving into that. You're still, because like, you know, the three character competencies, mm-hmm. we're going to raise up leaders, they're going to make an influence in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then somewhere along the way, they're going to see themselves larger than two or three.
Yes. Yeah, and one of the things to say is to affirm where they're at, but then to say, you know, if I understand where I think your heart is longing to go, then these are some things that as time goes on, you're going to need to grow in, where you're beginning to cast a vision for sort of where they need to be heading. You know, say like with character competence. Yes?
Don't you think with I'm a Generation Xer, and I think in trying to minister to other Generation Xers, one thing that I found is that they really, you know, like we talked about not being loyal to an organization,
uh-huh.
but really once they understand the heart of a leader and they
yes.
have a relationship with that,
yes.
like once I understand the heart of my leader,
mm-hmm.
and I have a relationship with my leader, then I'm loyal to my leader.
Mm-hmm.
And other people may fall, but I'm loyal
yes.
because I have a relationship.
And that's exactly, yes, of course, you're right, because you're the generation we're talking about. But it, one of the articles I wrote this year is called Trust, the Organizational Glue of the 90s. And with both what has happened in our corporate organizations with business process reengineering and flattening and all that, but even with the fuel that the Generation X is giving to it, it's all about trust. In terms of holding the thing together and retaining it, it is all about trust. It is not about brand loyalty. It is all about trust.
Well, I think a lot of the problem with the leadership deal is that people make commitments and they've not kept them.
Uh-huh.
They said, I will help you grow, I will help you do this.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the going gets tough, maybe they find some issues in your life that are really big, then they just.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. And see, I think on our side of it, we need to be careful what we promise we'll do for someone. You know, one of the things I try to say now is, if there is a way that I can help you, if I am able to do that, and if I believe that God wants me to do that, I will do it. And you can call that weenie-heartedness, but I call it integrity. Because I want them to always know, though I'm human and very sinful, I will do what I have said I would do. And you win trust there. And another thing for us older is we need to say the same thing back to them. You know, I need to be able to trust you. I need for you to help me to understand how to trust you. And when we feel like they have broken trust with us, to say that. Because it is a two-way street. Young Matt Sweeney that I told you about, as we, you know, you do discipleship differently than we used to, but as we entered into this discipleship relationship, it was very important to him that it was a two-way helping relationship. And that there were specific ways that we were lining out that he could help me as well as I help him. And I liked that. He came over and helped me clean up my office one day. You know, I don't think he liked that too much. I think he had a little more glamorous thing in mind. But